Thank you. Let's see. I've gotten better at public relations because when people used to ask me what I did when I was a grad student, I was working on the a solid-state physics problem, motion of vacancies in a crystal that was being calculated by classical mechanics in a computer. So I said, I imagine that you have 108 hard spheres bouncing against each other, but they're not really there, they're just calculated in a computer. So we have an imaginary, 108 imaginary atoms. Now take one of the imaginary atoms away. What I study is the absence of an imaginary atom. Well, I'm going to try to talk about some of these big questions and therefore not be able to answer them. But from the first, I'll think about talk about to what extent information is public and permanent, the relation between publicity and permanence or durability of information, and the forgetting of information. And then I'll talk about more the quality of information. When is the system complex? When is the information in it really interesting? I'll leave that for later, second half of the talk. But it used to be thought in classical mechanics that the future and past were completely determined by the present, and that our inability predict the future just came from ignorance of the initial conditions and computational weakness. But in the quantum view, it looks more as if, or at least one way of putting it, is that even an omniscient God or someone who knows the state of the world now would not be able to predict many things about the future. And so that seems to indicate some asymmetry because we seem to know a whole lot about the past. But there are some microscopic events in the past which are ambiguous in very much the same way as the future question of whether a particular atom will decay. And this would be like the which path information in an interferometer. So imagine we have a photon that goes and hits a beam splitter and follows these two paths, and then is reflected back to another beam splitter. And if the paths are equal, we get a constructive interference that always comes out there. So after the experiment is over, Niels Bohr would say, you should not even entertain the question of which path it followed. And so the general orthodox quantum mechanical viewpoint is that it's not a very good question to ask which of those two paths it followed if you didn't do anything that could find out which of the paths it followed. So, and to put it in my kind of physicist theological way, which rather upsets my sister-in-law, who is a clergywoman, she says, we don't think of God that way anymore, the way you physicists talk about God. After the experiment is over, God doesn't even remember which path it followed. Or to put it another way, any God who would remember which path it followed, I'm not interested in believing in that kind of God. So one of the beautiful and different things about quantum information is what we call the monogamy of entanglement. So if two systems are perfectly correlated with each other, that is, completely entangled with each other, they cannot share this correlation with anything else. They cannot even be classically correlated with a third system. You can capture that in the expression two is a couple and three is a crowd. And if, despite this, one of these parties attempts to share his entanglement with a third party or lets it leak out into the environment, then the entanglement is spoiled. Here's an example of it's being shared with the environment and thrown away. And then what you just have left between any two of these three parties is a classical correlation, not any more entanglement. The only way you can get an entangled state is to consider all three. So, I had a picture that I wanted to include here. It's getting long enough ago that people are trying to remember what the hippies were. Has anybody ever met a hippie here? So, well, the correlation that they share is independent of anything that of any correlation they have with this other system. Yeah. Oh right, another. So you're giving them an extra degree of freedom. So I can have. I should say that I think actually the hippies misunderstood entanglement. A metaphor I often give for it is that it was like two hippies who didn't have any opinion about anything. So they were completely random in their opinions, and yet they were sure that they were perfectly correlated with each other. They were perfectly in tune, and I venture also to say that the reason the hippie movement didn't succeed in its grander goals was because it misunderstood the monogamy of entanglement, and it was thought you could love everybody at once. So anyway, the exception that you cite is really more of a if I share an e-bit of entanglement with you, and I share an e-bit of entanglement with you, then I'm only one e-bit's worth of entangled with you. If I want to be completely entangled with you, I need to share all of my degrees of freedom, and then I couldn't possibly be correlated with him at all. That's what I meant by this monogamy. So this is very much connected to at least one of the ways of expressing what it means to be classical. Of course, it's the kind of the arrogance of the successful quantum information theory is to say, well, we know what information really is. It's quantum information, and the task is then to explain what everybody has been meaning all these years by classical information in quantum terms. So, taking this arrogant position, what does it mean for some information to be classical? Well, and we draw a quantum circuit. So one of the ways of expressing this has been expressed in many different languages by people who know more about it than I do here, but this is the one that seems especially attractive to me now. It's called the quantum Darwinism paradigm. So the idea is, in certain situations, you have a system that interacts with an environment, but the environment consists of a lot of parts that don't interact much with each other, but they interact with the system actually in ways that commute. And then what happens is that the system becomes correlated with the environment, becomes entangled with the environment, and it's entangled along any basis with the environment, but in a particular basis, it's entangled with each subsystem of the environment. So you get a preferred basis in which each one of these copies of the information in the system would agree, whereas if you considered a diagonal basis, then the system would be correlated with the collectivity of all these sub-environments, but not with any individual one. And this has been given the name quantum Darwinism, not because it has anything much to do with real Darwinism, I think the authors would admit. So this is not something that always happens when systems interact. It usually happens when the environment's not at thermal equilibrium, and as I say, when it has many subsystems that interact more strongly with the system than they do with each other. But fortunately, the Earth's environment is rather like that. And I'll say some more about that. So, you see quantum information, like which path particle takes through an interferometer is especially private. And the opposite of private information is something that we have a lot of nowadays, which is information that is perhaps excessively public. And so if you go outside in many parts of the world, you'll be in the view of video cameras, which will be, as far as you know, recording stuff that could be kept around for a long time. And some people worry about this, I would say rightly, in the, you know, what J. Edgar Hoover would do if he had modern equipment. But on the other hand, these things have sometimes socially beneficial. So, one of the peculiar American ideas is that it's a good idea for people to, it's healthy for society, for individuals to carry lethal weapons. And I've never, this has never particularly appealed to me, but I got a suggested improvement on that, which I call the Second Amendment for the Fourth Estate. And that is the idea that everybody should carry a camera. And so public policy should encourage amateurs to make audiovisual recordings, but then restrict how they can be used. And this is not a new idea of mine. In fact, CNN adopts this advertising slogan, which I saw on a billboard in Delhi. And it's amazing that we don't see that that slogan in the United States. But then getting back to science, it seems like I'm saying that there are really three levels of privacy. There are this quantum privacy, this information that only exists temporarily, and afterward can be best thought of as never having existed. And then there's this ordinary secrets, information that has been amplified. It's classical, what you have in your secret diary with the lock on it. And you can erase it and lie about it, but it's still classical. And then the public information, which is the kind that politicians usually try to deny. And so it seems now, it did seem to me for a long time that this modern world with all of the everything going being posted on YouTube and so on is very different from the pre-Gutenberg world, where information, it seems, often existed and was well-known and public and then died out. And it seems that in all cultures are full of this kind of loss of important information. And I found some examples. I've given a talk like this in various parts of the world, so I always try to customize it to the particular place. And these are some really impressive examples. There was one of, I think the emperor who united China wanted to make his rule more definitive, and tried to obliterate a great deal of the knowledge that had existed before then by commanding the burning of a great many books, but fortunately, some of the scholars who had been compelled to burn these books, memorized them, and rewrote most of them afterwards. Similarly, the more usual thing, I think, is what happened to a lot of the ancient Greek writings, especially those of Sappho. The language that they were written in became not well known, and they were just repurposed. Like the ones that they found, they used the papyruses for mummy wrapping because they couldn't read them, and now the. And then here's an impressive example of something that lasted for 2,000 years and died out a few centuries ago, and in an ironic way, that all we know about it is what critics said about it. So imagine some of your great scientific discoveries. Like the physical review is all lost, and your great article is lost, but the comment about it is what survives. So I thought that the world, the modern world, we have to learn with this flood of information that becomes permanent and then stays around forever. But then I became convinced that is not true, and that once public, always public is not true of all information. And you can certainly think of examples where information that nobody cares about very much is still lost on a massive scale. And here is some information that I cared about over 40 years ago, because I thought these raindrop marks and cracks were rather pretty, so I took a picture of them. But they were the original thing here didn't last more than a few days afterward. So the question is, if nobody had photographed them, would there be a physical record of them still in the universe, in principle? So at first I thought that this kind of macroscopic information, clearly has become classical. It's still there, just in an irrecoverable form, irrecoverable in practice. Like you say, when a book is burned, well, what people usually say, when you burn a book, in principle, you can recover it from the smoke and ashes. This is actually not true, because burning a book produces also photons. And if you don't save the photons, you can't invert the evolution of burning it. But if you save the, and phonons too, yes. So if you save everything, then maybe you could say, well, the book is still there and you can't really destroy anything, except maybe by throwing it into a black hole. And you get into arguments with people have different opinions about that. So maybe all these lost poems of Sappho really are there, we just don't know how to read them yet, but they're still there. And I was really seduced by this idea because I was so annoyed by these postmodernists who used to say that there isn't any real past or real history. If you say history is what happened, no, history is what people say about what happened. And that human belief systems are the thing that determines everything. And so this is very annoying to me and most scientists. So I really wanted this information to be there forever, but I think it isn't. And the reason is because of a kind of quantitative argument of a flow of entropy into and out of the Earth compared to the Earth's storage capacity. So I made some rough calculations about that. Let's see, well, what is the rate at which entropy leaves the Earth? Well, energy leaves the Earth at what was about 340 watts per square meter. It's the same rate at which it comes in, because I think the rate of heat production by radioactive decay is around something like 10,000 times smaller than what we get from the sun. So most of it comes in from the sun, and then it goes out in thermal radiation isotropically out in all directions. 300 watts per square meter, that's about 10 to the 30th bits per square meter. And, that's a lot of information flowing through the Earth. Suppose we tried to save it by recording it like in a tape. Well, what's a good example of something that records information for a long time, or potentially could record information for a long time? The best example I could think of was the formation of new crustal rock at the plate boundaries, at the spreading plate boundaries, where liquid rock freezes and then it stays frozen for a couple hundred million years until it gets remelted again in the subduction zone. So, and you could say that any kind of piece of rock might have an information storage density around on the order of a 1 bit per cubic nanometer, in the sense of just a molecular disorder, atomic disorder that's frozen in well enough to last for millions of years if you don't heat the rock up too much. And so calculating that through, we get a storage capacity in the crust of about 10 to the 22nd bits per square meter, which isn't nearly enough to store everything that's going on in the Earth. Well, then what about what people do? Of course, I have five grandchildren, and I take lots of pictures. I, as you can see, I believe in photography. Everybody should take pictures all the time. So suppose I generate 100 gigabits of pictures per year, which isn't too far off, and there are a billion other people who are similarly heavy information users. That comes up to 10 to the 21st bits per year, which is looking pretty big, except that this one is per square meter. So it looks like we've got a problem here. If we want to catch up with everything that happened, we'd have to chase these photons, and that's a little hard to do considering how fast they go. So I'm tempted to add a new level of privacy, which is the classical information that is escaped. That is, it's no longer available on Earth. It's in the universe. I began talking about this with Chris Fuchs, who has very different views of quantum mechanics from mine. So it's a very constructive discussion whenever I talk to him. And eventually I came around to something, I would say it's a viewpoint of mine that was inspired by listening to him. I don't know if he likes it any better than what I believed before. So let's go over some of these old, I'll tell you about this viewpoint a little later, examples of these kinds of things about the past. Here are some that are pretty clearly still recorded on Earth, though it may be impractical to recover them. And then here's some things which we don't know. They may have escaped, or they may be still recorded here. And then there are some things that are pretty definitely escaped. Jim Gray is a computer scientist of considerable renown, who I think he went on a sailing trip and never came back, sailing his own boat. Does anyone know what the story of him is? Yeah. It's not too different from what happened to Majorana, actually. Yeah. Jimmy Hoffa was a different story. Okay, well, speaking of Jimmy Hoffa, suppose you actually wanted to make sure the information of how he disappeared escaped. They first of all, you ought to get rid of the body in a way that doesn't leave any traces. And then it's important not to tell anybody. And then, of course, maybe your own memory has some physical basis. So it would be good just to have yourself cremated, too. And then, of course, you might say, well, the person that you have cremating your ashes and dissolving them in putting them into the ocean, you might have to try to explain why you were asking them to do that, but you shouldn't be too many details in that explanation. But suppose you wanted to do the opposite, and you wanted to make some information very long-lasting. The way you do that, of course, is to, why would you want to? Maybe you want to preserve important works of literature, or for this sort of socially beneficial purpose. Sometimes it's pretty unsafe to publicize some misdeed, but if there is the if there's the realization that it is being preserved and will eventually come out, that's a disincentive to the bad conduct. And then, of course, there's this reason, but that's pretty futile because you can't preserve all of it. But suppose you wanted to preserve some things, and then you would do the usual thing. You just record it in some very long-lasting medium and make many copies of it. But now it's, as I said, maybe something like this is accidentally happening. Well, I won't say if it's accidentally happening, but suppose we wanted to store a lot of information, and if we just take this notion of what is the classical information that we care about and make it a bit more macroscopic. So let's say we wanted to do a video surveillance of the entire surface of the Earth at millimeter-millisecond resolution, not at some atomic resolution. Well, that turns out to be around 10 to the 16th bits per square meter per year. So that, in principle, you could record all that and store it in the crustal rocks. But of course, it would be a pretty technically difficult process, except that I began to wonder, is it maybe happening automatically without a deliberate human effort? Because in a sense, we've got a random transformation from the state of the Earth to the state of these freezing crustal rocks, which is mathematically a kind of a hash function or a random unitary. And could it be that that is already doing this nasty thing? That this CIA can go down and dig up bits of the ocean floor and find out everything they want to know about us. Well, probably not. Because the general property of these random mappings is that if you recover a minority share of the output of the mappings, you have almost no information about a minority share of the input. The fact that the input is this 10 to the 22nd bits, and I'm only being able to save 10 to the 16th bits of it, it means that probably most of those 10 to the 16th bits are not correlated with anything I would want to know about the 10 to the 22nd. To the extent that the mapping is random, it's uninformative. The information that's stored is stored because rare information gets cared about or accidentally fossilized. It's not a natural byproduct of the freezing of the rocks that they're saving important information. So here's a few more questions. Is it really impossible to recapture this escaped information? And what is the ontological status of it? Does the universe remember where the raindrops fell, even though the Earth has forgotten? Do we need randomness coming in from the sun to make the Earth forget things? And then, of course, it was somewhat arbitrary for me to talk about the crust of the Earth. What about the whole body of the Earth, the mantle, which has a lot more degrees of freedom? I'll try to address all these questions. What about getting the escape radiation back? Well, this is certainly possible for the non-thermalized radiation, like a optical image of the Earth could be examined by an extraterrestrial camera. In fact, it is all the time. At least orbiting cameras are looking at the Earth. That's how we get Google Earth. I guess they say that the extraterrestrial civilizations might listen to our old TV broadcasts and then beam them back to us after we'd forgotten them. But this doesn't happen to most information. But suppose you wanted to save all of it. Then you'd have a rather of a severe global warming problem. And now you might say, what about just outrunning the radiation because the refractive index of space is a little greater than one. But I think that's trumped by the cosmological. Does somebody knows here how big the cosmological constant is compared to the refractive index of intergalactic space? Well, the question is, do the distant galaxies disappear from view? Yeah, okay, so I think that says that the So if the space were filled up with water and we could go somewhat faster than the speed of light in the medium, yeah. So I think that the answer is that we lose it, yeah, eventually. So that doesn't work very well. Now let's look at this. I wanted to get back to this ontological status of this escaped information. This is the way in which I've been influenced by Chris Fuchs. And so I'm saying, well, this is, we have some classical information. It comes about in the consequence of some quantum and thermal fluctuations, but the raindrop doesn't fall in a superposition of places. And independent observers would agree about where it fell. And then it will live up to this quantum Darwinist paradigm by having this crater reflect innumerable replicas of itself, in the sense of sunlight shining on it and going off into space. But then when the crater gets washed away, the original earthly embodiment of it will be gone, and the optical replicas of it will be escaping, and then we would say that it has become escaped information. So let's look at this in the quantum information Procrustean way of looking at things. We first of all collapse the raindrop to having only two possible locations where it might fall. And then let's look at the initial state of it. So it's going to fall, and we'll have some terrestrial degrees of freedom indicated by this brown color, and the celestial degrees of freedom, the photons going off into the sky. And of course, from God's point of view, we have this superposition. But from the viewpoint of any observer on the Earth, we'll see one of these things. And these L's all agreeing with that L mean that everybody agrees that it fell in one place or the other. And it's only God thinks that it could be in both places. Well then, as time goes on, the terrestrial replicas get reduced in number, and the celestial ones increase, and then finally, it's all in the sky. So this means that the Earth is in a product state with the sky, which is in a superposition of thinking that it fell on the left and the right. Well, then this says that once that has happened, once the information is completely escaped, it's a bit more reasonable for us earthly people to say it fell in the superposition of places. We didn't used to think that, but now it's sort of unreasonable to say that it fell in one of the places or the other. So this is, I think, captured by a quote that I've heard attributed to Wheeler. So this is, and this is actually in the part of popular culture. So you can, these things are on sale for a couple of dollars, but I just took a picture of it. I asked the guy at the flea market if I could take a picture of it, because it's a pretty useless thing to own. But the idea is that after enough time has gone by, you wouldn't say in 2009, in this spot, nothing happened, because people would start arguing with you immediately. They would say, well, I was here yesterday and I lost my hat, or something like that. But in 1832, well, maybe there are places where nothing happened, or where everything that happened has escaped. What? Well, nothing that anybody remembers happened. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody remembers what happened here. That would be a better way of saying it. But well, that's right. Yes, somebody would remember if nothing happened. Right, yes. You'd write about it. Okay, so is the random information input necessary to cause randomization of the Earth? No, and this is pretty well known in quantum information. That is, you can randomize a system but just by letting information escape from it. In other words, creating entanglement and losing part of it. So in, you could imagine taking the sun and replacing it by a laser of equal brightness. And so we would have an input of solar energy that was of very little entropy. And yet the Earth would function in about the same way as it did, and that be as like a giant down converter, where it's producing these heavily entangled modes that all individually looked random and looked like thermal radiation. So now, what about the interior of the Earth? When I first thought about this, I tried to do that calculation again with the phonons and photons in the Earth-sized mass of hot rock. And it turns out that they have an entropy about a million times greater than the annual entropy flux out of the Earth. So this would say if you disposed of Haffa deep underground so as to trap all the disposal products, all the phonons, maybe he would be stuck in the Earth for 500,000 years. But I think that the answer to that is no, pretty much for the same argument I made about the hashing, that is that we don't know the initial state of the, or you might say we don't know the purification of the random state of the Earth. And therefore, we would have to recover all that as well as the present state in order to find out what happened to Haffa. So here's another question about information loss. It's well known that a black body radiation carries no information about the object it illuminates. And this is this surprising thing that for every time you see it, if you see it for the first time, you look inside a pottery kiln where these pots are baking. And even though the pots could be all different colors and covered with the glazes and markings of different colors, you see nothing except a bright orange glow. And here is a picture taken of a baking pottery. And you can see a little bit of details here because it's not completely isothermal. And the fact that I opened up the hole to look in means the radiation field isn't isotropic exactly. But it's pretty close to featureless. And so the question is, that I was wondering about, is if the thermal radiation doesn't carry information about the objects it illuminates, perhaps it doesn't decohere them. And that's like how could such a hot place, I mean, how can you look for entanglement in hell? You know, it must be a very decoherent place. So there must be something wrong about this argument. So this gives us the opportunity to exercise another one of the habits of quantum information theorists. Here's what it looks like if you actually shine a light in through the, and that is to say, well, what did I mean by this mixed state of the thermal radiation that illuminated these pots? Well, we can imagine it as being part of a larger entangled system in a pure state, and this reference system is necessary for really understanding what's going on. And then that gives the answer to the question, because if considered, though this density matrix is a thermal density matrix, and this is the same one, this entangled state has been transformed by the interaction with the pots. And so this is just a version of Wiesner's superdense coding, where you take part of an entangled state, you operate on it in various ways, and you transform the entangled state into a number of distinguishable orthogonal states, even though the subsystem by itself hasn't been changed at all. It continues to appear maximally mixed. So the summary of this part of the talk is that classical information, most of it is lost. Occasionally, it gets fossilized, and it can last for billions of years. The escaped information still exists in the universe, but we have little justification for thinking that one alternative actually happened and the other one didn't. I've argued that this escaped information no longer has a preferred value, but it still has a preferred basis. In other words, we could say that it's no longer possible to say the raindrop fell in the left place or the right place, but without going out into the universe and doing some terrible things to all these escaping photons, we can still say that it's in a superposition of having fallen in the left and the right, not in all these photons being agreeing with it in some other basis. So the basis is more permanent than the value. Now, I was talking about this to a number of people, including especially interested in this was Rüdiger Schach. And after he listened to my talk, he said, if I had to choose, I would prefer that Sappho's lost poems had a real value that we don't know than that the wave function of the universe is real. All right, so that's the end of part one of the talk. Part two is, well, what about this information? Why would we care about some information? And can we find a non-anthropocentric definition of what kind of information is worth remembering? And what is the connection between this complexity and thermal equilibrium? And I have a few things to say about that. I thought about that a number of years ago, and it's not an area which me or anybody else has made any great progress. But it's still, I think, it's something we should all be thinking about from time to time. Of course, this known that a simple cause can have a complicated effect, but not right away. And you can make these toy models of self-organization, which are quite pretty. Here's one of my favorite models. It's a one-dimensional reversible cellular automaton. And I've started it off here at time zero with an initial state that's periodic except for some small defect. And this defect produces this deterministic wake. And actually, if I started it up in this state and ran it backwards, the wake would undo itself and go back to that. And so the small irregularity produces this large, complicated, random-looking, but not actually random, outcome. And if you were to let this wake run for a while and then take a piece of it, not even the whole thing, just take a sort of piece of it up there, the fact that it is not random and actually admits a very concise description of how it could get to be there means that it contains internal evidence of a complicated history. And that's going to be my criterion for complexity. And whereas if I took too small a piece like that, there would be a lot of explanations for how that could have come into being. It's like the difference between the evidence of a fingerprint, of a whole fingerprint, and evidence of just one or two lines, which could point to anything. So what about real wakes? If I have, like here's a wake behind a stepping stone in a river, does this somewhat beautiful and complicated thing have some complexity in the sense of it containing evidence about its past, maybe a year ago? Can I look at the wake and figure out that there was a rain 2 weeks ago? I don't know. This is some hydrodynamic question. And speaking of hydrodynamics, I was inspired by some very old work of Günter Ahlers, who's here, but he's not here right now in the physics department. He was doing a convective turbulence experiment on helium, liquid helium, but not superfluid helium, just ordinary helium, treating helium as an ordinary liquid. I guess he had an apparatus that had helium in it, so he says, well, let's do this experiment. So the idea is that you heat the helium from below, and that produces a convective instability. And of course, you could imagine taking a picture of it and putting little bits of confetti in to see how the helium moves around, but that's pretty infeasible. So the easiest thing to do is just to measure the temperature difference between the top and the bottom. and that measures, at least in one parameter way, or one independent, dependent variable way, how efficient the convection is at that moment in conducting heat from the, getting heat from the bottom to the top. And he found some pretty, they found some pretty strange results there. They found that the heat flux varied rather aperiodically over a rather long time, and that if they started the experiment up, it would do the same thing. Well, it wouldn't always do the same thing. It did several things, but each one of them was somewhat reproducible over a period of days. So this says that this thing, which doesn't appear to be having a, of course you could say something that goes on for a long time, a computation, has a long and purposeful aperiodic sequence. That's what a computer is designed to do. But things that are not computers are usually more susceptible to being upset by environmental influences. We typically think of them as chaotic. So they either do the same thing, it's a very simple thing, or they do something that's very unpredictable, and so every time you run it, it comes out different. But this was something that was more computer-like than most phenomena in hydrodynamics. So I asked him, and I think he wasn't really sure, he hadn't thought about it much lately, if there are other examples of this phenomenon and where you get it in hydrodynamics. So getting around to trying to formalize this definition of complexity, I've proposed something called, which is based on this Occam's razor principle, and that says, well, of course, we have some phenomenon to be explained, we want to choose the most economical explanation. And the economical, when we speak of economy, we do not refer to the length of the deductive path, we refer to the input of axioms, if independent axioms. So we prefer the briefest hypothesis to explain the phenomenon, and then once we've accepted that, we should have to live with this deductive path. So if the simplest explanation of the spectrum of a carbon disulfide molecule has to come from computations involving quantum mechanics, and that takes a lot of time on a computer, well, we say, well, if it gives the right answer, we have to accept those computations as reasonable. Now, if you computerize this whole idea, you get an idea that's connected with algorithmic information theory, and that says, well, let's take the object that we're trying to assess the complexity of, represent it, digitize it, and now consider the alternative explanations of it as inputs to a standard universal computer. We accept an input as successful if it causes the computer to embark on a computation which produces exactly this object and nothing else as its output. And of course, anything can be computed as the result of various different computer programs. For example, there's a simple program that just says describe the object by itself and do nothing, and so this is a program which, that's one of the alternate explanations. But we prefer the shortest, and we'll say, well, we don't focus on the length of this explanation, which is the Kolmogorov complexity or algorithmic information content of this. We focus on the length of the computational path, the runtime of the most concise description. And that's what we try to use for the formal definition of complexity here. So now, in this sense, these orderly sequences are shallow. A random sequence is shallow because it's its own shortest description, and it can be quickly computed from that. And now, if we take some system and let it run like that reversible cellular automaton for a long time, and it's comparable to its Poincaré time, we get a rather random-looking thing like this. Of course, it's not random. It's deterministic at every stage. But this typical snapshot of it will have only local correlations in it and won't have any particular evidence of a long history if we wait for such a long time. So this is something like waiting for the system to come to its heat death and looking at a microscopic configuration. So there is still some complexity here, but it's complexity of the dynamics. So if I took two time slices, they would contain evidence of the duration of the computation between them, but each one of them individually would look rather random. So this says that if you lived in a world at thermal equilibrium, you wouldn't be able to appreciate this complexity because you would be confined to one time slice. And so now let's look at this from another, compare thermal equilibrium with non-equilibrium. As I said, in an equilibrium world, the correlations are generically local and mediated through the present. But in a world out of equilibrium, I gave the other example, but let's take something from the real world. These are two coins from Grenada in Canada, both containing a portrait of Elizabeth II, although not the same portrait, and the coins are actually different shapes. But the reason that there is a similarity between them has nothing to do with having been in contact or being near each other. It has to do with a V-shaped path in space-time, or to put it in a slightly historically crude way, that has to do with not with Elizabeth II, but Elizabeth I. So now what is the connection between departure? Can I formalize more the connection between dissipation or departure from equilibrium and this kind of complexity? And I think that some progress is possible here, because there are arguments as to why thermal equilibrium states are generically shallow. Now, what I mean generically is I mean take a system in finite dimensions, finite number spatial dimensions, let the parts locally interact with each other, and let the coupling constants be chosen arbitrarily, so that there are not there's no symmetry to be spontaneously broken. And then under that kind of generic conditions, the Gibbs phase rule says that there will be a unique bulk phase of a Gibbs phase of minimal free energy, and that one will eventually dominate, so that the system doesn't have a capacity for long-term memory, and therefore, as you make it larger and larger, its ability to remember the result of a long computation is it doesn't grow. So here's an example of a phase diagram. So it's in order to get more than one phase coexisting here, you have to go to a special value of pressure and temperature, not a generic value. Now there is an exception to this Gibbs phase rule in more than four dimensions, I think, for quantum systems, at four or more dimensions, where we can have you can have degenerate ground states even in the face of symmetry breaking, at least in local symmetry breaking perturbations. But unfortunately, four dimensions is a little hard to get to. I think it doesn't work in anything less. Do we have any experts here on this? Debbie, do you know how that works? I mean, and Sergey, we used to talk about that. When I said Gibbs phase rule, he says, well, now you can put in, let's say you can have a model that has local interactions, and you can put in local fields acting on each individual. Essentially, you can get two phases that are different because of entanglement, and yet have the same local correlation functions, so the symmetry breaking perturbation doesn't break the symmetry between those phases. But he says, so I may be wrong about this, but I believe that it is an exception, and if it is an exception, you have to go to an excessively large number of spatial dimensions to get it. So you might say that part of the question is in pretty good shape. Of course, you can get very complicated things if you violate any of these things, like a non-generic parameter value, or a zero temperature, or long-range interactions, or you know, those things. But so this Gibbs phase rule is pretty powerful. Conversely, you might ask, what is required besides disequilibrium in order to get some unbounded growth of complexity in the system? Well, I thought of an example of this. Here's a system that looks like it has dissipation without having much complexity. So we have, again, a case of thermal convective turbulence, but we put on the temperature gradient backwards, so that the bottom is cold and the top is hot, and so it will just turn into a stratified condition, which I guess is familiar in the weather here in the Los Angeles area. We get a just what looks like a very simple dissipative steady state, where there's just conduction through this water without any motion. But you can argue that is in a way a special condition, that if you make a kind of generic perturbation of it, it will again acquire the capacity to become complicated. And my generic perturbation is to dissolve a few miscellaneous minerals in the water. And then we get the possibility of something like this, that the minerals could fluctuate into a sort of the hardware of a turbine civilization, where people are exploiting the temperature difference to make electricity and grow food, and the people are smart enough so that they've got some redundancy in this structure, and if it breaks down, they come and fix it, and it spreads and colonizes the whole thing. So it's very hard to argue against this kind of possibility complexity to sneak in. And indeed, the mathematical arguments connected with this sort of thing, of that is whether you can take a one-dimensional cellular automaton, a dissipative one, and have it self-organize, appears to be that even in one dimension it can do it. Even though all the local transition probabilities are positive. So it has a chance of making every possible mistake, and yet it can correct its errors even in one dimension. This is the work of Peter Gotch. This is classical. So then, well, you can say, well, maybe there are some environments that are so hot and so rapidly mixing as to preclude some long-term memory. And so the obvious place to go is to say, well, what about the center of the Earth? It must be pretty inhospitable down there, or the sun. Well, you know that if you go in, recently it's been discovered that there are bacteria that live in rocks pretty far down in the Earth. So I think probably nothing lives in the core, but it's a little hard to make a rigorous argument that nothing could. And similarly, you just look at the sun and you see there's complicated things going on there, and maybe you'd have to go into the core of the sun where it's hotter and less structured. So this is, I would say, an area of science to take these dissipative systems and make rigorous arguments as to which ones really are going to stay simple and can never do anything else. And then you could say, well, there are also some, you can certainly make toy models like models of a ferromagnet or something, where it's capable of memory, but not of course that ferromagnet is cheating because it's a equilibrium model with a spontaneously broken symmetry. But you can make other models where they can have memory, but they can't become complicated. But in the biological world, the analogous question is there some kind of environment an environment that's dissipative but inherently dead, or perhaps more interestingly, where you can have life, but greater complexity does not offer any selective advantage. So the only things that live there are simple, and they're going to be simple forever. And that would mean, essentially, from speaking this in a more biological viewpoint, is that the environment is one that does not generate exploitable niches, or the opportunity for some accidental structure to help the organism do something that it couldn't otherwise do. So I don't know, and if we haven't read much of the biological literature, what what has been said about that kind of a possibility for a sterile environment? What? Oh, right. In other words, that. Oh, yeah. Well, simple. Yes, that's right. Compared to what? Right. Yeah. I think that. So the question is, the proper, rigorous way of posing that question would be: is there a biological environment that generates only humble organisms? In other words, ones that don't have an inflated view of their own complexity. All right, that's a good place to stop, I think. Yeah, I think that these arguments, it's very, I made them in terms of the Earth, but it's just very, very clear. Yeah. Yeah, it can do its thing, but it can't remember what it did. Yeah. Oh, really?
A great movement for writing Geschichte is Eigengeschwar, which in modern terms would be what sort of infinity of video cameras and tape recorders.
The history that's really, really true, yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, that proved to be a fruitless exercise. People realize that. You can't write it. With many writers from the standpoint of someone who's got a point of view, literally and metaphorically, which means they've got a set of questions that they're wanting to ask, and they're wanting to collect the information that's relevant to those questions. And the modern equivalent of that is in the information world of medical science, where there's now, where there is now, with the genome building, an overwhelming amount of data. Unfeasible for any medical practitioner to wade their way through. So again, we've got to extract the information that's relevant. Now, does this insight, that it all depends on the question that we're asking, help with this thing of how you can store the information from vast amounts of original data and so on?
Well, I think I make many gigabytes of pictures every year, and I'm guilty of taking some pictures that I never look at, and that these large biological databases are a little bit like that problem. If you gather so much information, eventually you may get stuff that nobody cares about enough to even look at it, let alone choose it and excerpt it and write about it. And then, if nobody cares about it, eventually it's going to be lost because you cannot store all of it. So I think that that's somewhat the relation. So which of Geschichte and Historia, which was supposed to be the interpretation, which was supposed to be the accurate record? Yeah. You're talking to somebody who wasn't alive in the 19th century, right? Yeah.
Why do we say one of the best case, the humanist, or the light scatter of the raindrops, or not to say that it is effectively night, the people position, people
Yeah, but...
Information about whether the rainbow was dead or alive is existing in classical form somewhere in a classical space-time. It's not a pure quantum information like the one in the double experiment where it was never evolved, whether it can accept it or not.
Well, I would argue... you're going back to the interferometer here. So you're saying that at this point, the information never existed. You could have intercepted this beam and known which path it was in. You can have the quantum eraser experiment where you actually, there is some system that knows, and then its information about which path was followed is carefully canceled out and erased. And so we then come back to restoring interference. And what I'm arguing is that the escape of these optical replicas of terrestrial information, once it's all escaped, it's as if the Earth is doing a quantum... Yeah, it's a guess that escapes. I think there are examples in which it does escape, just based on this entropy balance. There are phonons that go into the ground and bounce around inside for a long time. But I think you can make arguments based on random unitary mappings that the Earth eventually really gets to be in a product state with this. Now, it's a sort of philosophical question to say, does this mean it has a position and we just don't know it? Certainly somebody out in the space that was looking at this would say one of those was real and the other was a possibility. But if we are in a product state with all of those degrees of freedom which know the answer to the question, and equally valid and to my philosophical aesthetic viewpoint, a more satisfying explanation is to say that the part of the universe that we do not have access to is in a superposition rather than being in one of two states, and I don't know which one it is. Since we can undo measurements, and everybody agrees that you have done and undone a measurement when you've made a quantum eraser experiment, I say when the world does something that looks a lot like a quantum eraser experiment, by just letting the degrees of freedom that carry the answer escape rather than by canceling them, that maybe it's just as well to say that we are restored to a more Olympian viewpoint. Now, Rüdiger Schock doesn't believe that. He says, you know, the thing happens and it still has happened. If you went out in space, you would... So I guess what it really says is, going back to this thing of... where it is, Schock, what he says... I don't know that it's lost. Oh, yeah, there is some possibility that... Where did it even go, anyway? That's speaking of lost information. Anyway, that's... It's right around here somewhere, I know. Anyway, Schock said... he likes to think that these lost literatures have actual values. Not they're all possible poems that Sappho could have written, but the formalism of quantum mechanics does not compel us to interpret it that way. Yes. That's right. Yeah.
Quantum mechanics are analogs. You know,
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so that's why I think that these, that I categorize them as things that may be classical secrets or may be escaped. We don't know. Because until the last one was found, it was also thought to be a lost poem. Yeah. Well, you can set up examples where you probably can be sure that it escapes. There may be somewhat toy examples, but not ones people care about. Yeah.
There's a very nice experiment by the Japanese in Vienna. They're using essentially a two-slit, using a colored well.
Yeah.
And they pass heated cotton wool through the two-slit. And if the temperature is low enough, they went very warm. It's using a very pattern. But as they heated hotter and hotter, and the wavelength gets shorter and shorter, just at the time that the record
the buckyball went through. Yeah, I was talking to Schilinger about this experiment, and I said, what if you use graduate students instead of buckyballs? And he said, well, the graduate students would say they were in a dark place, and they're worrying about the exam that they were supposed to take in 3 or 4 days, and they remembering the dinner they'd eaten, and they didn't see which slit they went through. So, in other words, you can have the fact that these buckyballs don't have to be in the ground state means that they can have all kinds of excitations and even internal processes. You could do it with live things, as long as they were, and as I say, in the product state with the which path degree of freedom. Right, yeah, if you had it, video cameras with a short enough wavelength that they could see the slits, then that would definitely spoil it. Unless you caught the video cameras and before you looked at them, reversed their evolution and erased their tapes. Yes. Oh, yeah, okay, let's go. Oh, it's this way. Oh, this, the computerized Occam's razor?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have some allowed error bounds. What happens to your measure of the complexity?
Well, these are all sort of somewhat stable, because suppose we put some errors here, then we can always compute the deviated version of this by this program with a little extra instruction saying where to put the errors in. Yes. So the something that I left uncommented on here is, supposing you have a close tie between programs of almost equal length, one of them runs very quickly and the other one takes the age of the universe to run. Which one do you believe? If the one that runs the age of the universe is even one bit shorter, do you only accept that one? And so you really have to fuzz out these definitions a little bit to say that an object has logical depth D with a confidence level of let's say 1 and 2 to the n, if the only programs that compute it in less than time D are at least n bits longer than the ones that time less than the n. So in other words, you have to fuzz out the definitions in order to make them stable with respect to small changes in the object, or indeed in the universal computer that executes the program, which is somewhat arbitrary. But being universal, they can all be programmed to simulate one another with a constant translation program, but a constant translation program of not of order 103 bits, but of order kilobits or something like that. So these definitions all need to be, it's really not a single parameter, it's a rejecting the null hypothesis at a certain level of confidence. And the null hypothesis was that this thing was computed in time less than t.